Rather come up here, you're welcome to do that as well. A couple of quick points about tonight's meeting. It was advertised as a public meeting, not a public hearing. And that means if you want to give formal comments as part of the comment period that ends tomorrow, you should do that through the ways that were advertised. There is not a transcript being made of this meeting. There is a note taker. The gist of the conversation, the dialogue, will be captured, but it won't necessarily have your name and it won't be verbatim. So if you do have specific comments, you're urged to hand those in separately, although tonight's dialogue will not be lost. So that's just kind of a heads up for you. With that, there's also Jim's talk tonight. There's I think I got most of you a handout. If you need one, wave your hand at me and I'll give you one of these. The top says draft long-term stewardship study. Right at the top with a, well, let me bring it back to you. And lastly, there was a sign-in sheet up here asking for names and mailing addresses for any follow-on information that goes out. If you came in the back door and didn't sign in, if you could get it on your way out, I'll also put one out with the other materials on the table so you can sign it in your way out as well. Yes?
Comments?
Sure.
Right.
First question is the specifics of the 15th. Jim, do you want to speak about it or have Greg address it?
Get started.
Okay.
Why don't I just get started and answer that right off to start with all of them. I wonder if we can get rid of the feedback. It seems to be going away. The answer is yes. Just send them in as soon as you can. And that's really part of the background of what tonight's meeting is about. We should make sure that people are clear on what this is and what it is not. Let me wait till you're done there. So you can, and I was going to get into why this is. I think it's, if I get close to that speaker, it does the feedback thing, which actually could be like a Laurie Anderson thing.
Let me
explain why it's fine to send it in a little bit late. Send it in as soon as possible, but it's not like a strict deadline. I mean, usually you have these deadlines when there's a legal issue whereby you have to raise something in a comment period for it to be litigable, for you to be able to raise a lawsuit. David Ailman, correct me if I'm wrong here. You have to have it on the record and submitted to a docket by a certain date for you to be able to litigate it later after the decision's made. We don't have a decision here, so this is not like the document's litigable, unless it were totally suicide on, but hopefully that won't happen. But the comment period date won't matter a whole lot. But just get it in. I mean, some of these folks, I mean, Bob, do you have any plans for Christmas?
Not anymore.
Okay. I'm hoping some of these folks don't have to work all the way through Christmas. They can, you know, get the comments in, turn around, send it to me. Okay? Well, let me try to explain what tonight's meeting is about, because may not be obvious to everybody here, though some people I know, like Jackie and Dave, have been involved with this process for quite some time, so you know in detail. But for those of you who don't, I wanted to do a little bit of a presentation to discuss the issue. Actually, this is very therapeutic for a bureaucrat, because if I go near the overhead projector, it decalcifies my spinal cord with the feedback.
Jim, you'll keep doing it until adjusted on the fly.
Oh, okay. Doing this. So let me talk about long-term stewardship generally, and then talk about some of the various activities the department is doing. If you are here for a meeting on stockpile stewardship, that flight leaves first class on another gate. We are here for the stewardship involving the nuclear weapons cleanup program, or so-called cleanup program, for lack of a better name. We use the word cleanup, and that'll be one thing we'd love to get comments on. If somebody has a better word than cleanup, please let us know. We haven't been able to come up with one, but we call it cleanup for lack of a better word. But this whole thing came about as a result of a lawsuit settlement that I'll talk about in a bit. But it came about as a result of a whole lot more than just a lawsuit settlement. And let me describe a little bit of the background on this. I know a lot of folks here deal with individual sites like Livermore or Berkeley, but we're here from Washington, and we're here to help. We're doing this as a national study. That is, we're trying to look at policy issues, not looking at individual sites. And I've just put up a map of all the sites in the United States where we currently expect to have contamination after cleanup is done. So we've got over 100 facilities in the United States where after we finish spending $200 billion, we're going to have contamination left, and there's going to be a need to watch over these sites, to provide monitoring, record keeping, maintenance, public information, all the other work you've got to do that we call long-term stewardship. So it's a pretty daunting task, and just one of those dots, for example, is Hanford. Just one of those dots is Livermore. Just one of those dots is, well, I don't know, is Santa Susana? What's the status of Santa Susana? Are we
long-term stewardship. The contract.
We're claiming we're going to get all the contamination out of there?
Or the contractor will assume responsibility.
Okay. Well, anyway, sir, already I lied to you, so I've done my bureaucratic duty. I said I wasn't going to get into site-specific issues, and we did. But we're trying not to go into site-specific issues because, you know, there really is not the kind of money. The site-specific issues really need to be resolved with individual communities. I don't want to presume to come from Washington and talk to you guys about Livermore or come from Washington and tell the Hanford people how to deal with Hanford. That has to be dealt with at the individual site level. But there is a broader issue to be addressed. And as you'll see from reading the study, really a range of issues, if we're really going to grapple with this whole issue of what do you have to do if you're really going to leave contamination behind after the cleanup's done. And we, frankly, have not completely grappled with that. And I think getting feedback from folks here tonight could help us a whole lot in that. And that's, I hope, the big outcome of this. But over the past 5 years or so, the department has done a series of national studies. And again, we're trying to take a national perspective. And it may not seem to be day-to-day issues, but I guess I would argue that there is a place for these kind of broader national studies to be done, and that's what we're involved in. We've done studies, for example, that show that the total cost for the environmental management program is about $200 billion. And one of the interesting outcomes of that study was not so much the cost, but rather that at 4,000 sites across the country, individual communities and DOE officials and regulators were coming up with an answer for cleanup that meant that contamination would be left in place. This is not something we're dictating from Washington. We have virtually no role in what is decided in an individual site, but we ask individual sites, what are you deciding in conjunction with your regulators and stakeholders? And they've told us that we're going to be leaving material left in place. And you know, there's as many reasons for that as there are sites, but generally the reasons are because we don't have the technology to exhume an entire landfill. If you do, you have to move it to some other landfill, or there's no technology to remove all the contaminated groundwater, or if you tried, it would just cost more money than we have right now, more money than Congress is willing to give us, and that's a different branch of government that's not represented here tonight. We've clearly spent a whole bunch of money already, and the question is, again, what have we gotten for that? We spent $60 billion already in this environmental management program, we've already made a lot of decisions that's going to leave material in place. So somebody could argue, well, why weren't you having this discussion 10 years ago? That's a good point. Perhaps we should have, but the fact is we're here tonight, and we are discussing it for the future. We've already made decisions that left a lot of material in place in spending that $60 billion. We acknowledge that we are going to have to deal with the consequences of leaving material in place. This is not something that the department can ever walk away from. If you transfer ownership or title, as I understand it legally, we still hold the bag. The U.S. government, the Department of Energy, still is obligated to maintain consistent sites to protect public health and the environment. That doesn't go away. We've done a whole series of studies. Congress has gotten involved a little bit. And I wanted to talk about one report in particular that is useful. And if anybody was here for the sessions earlier today, you heard, I think, a good speaker talk about this National Academy of Sciences study. But they really raised a big challenge to all of us, not just the department, but anybody who is concerned with protecting public health and the environment. They basically spent 3 years writing a study that said, we don't see that it's going to work. They said that they don't have confidence that long-term stewardship is going to be effective for the long run, that there aren't the institutions in place, there aren't the technologies in place, there aren't the funding mechanisms in place. They just don't see the evidence that we are going to be able to effectively maintain control of the sites after cleanup is done. They said that, you know, you've got certain principles you should follow. they call them strategic objectives. You should plan for uncertainty. Life is uncertain. You should plan for failure, that you've got to deal with almost the certainty that failure will occur. You've got to set up redundancies. There are a number of recommendations they made, and we're still in the process of trying to incorporate those. But a lot of that's going to have to be translated to your individual site eventually. But you know, we're not here to talk about, again, individual sites of each one of those 108 sites across the country. We're here to talk about, you know, how we might be able to make this work or the consequences if it doesn't work, possibly, and dealing with all the issues associated with it. But I think this is a very useful summary, and I recommend it to everybody. And, of course, I should have to advertise the DOE report. We did a report. Actually, this was 4 or 5 years ago we did the first draft of this, and with the lightning speed of the government, we finally published it last year, 1 year ago. But it's not a big revelation, but it does introduce the issues and has some useful photographs to give you a sense of the wide variety of situations around the country where, you know, 50 years of nuclear weapons production has created problems that essentially can't be undone. And that's an observation a lot of people have made, that right now you can go to Nagasaki or Hiroshima and buy a bowl of noodle soup or a hot dog and, you know, pretty happily walk across the public square there. But there are a lot of places in the United States that have been contaminated to an extent where you can't go there anymore as a result of making that product. Let me talk for a moment again about the overall study. This study we're doing tonight is actually legally required by a lawsuit settlement that the Natural Resources Defense Council and 38 or so mainly environmental group plaintiffs around the United States brought against the Department of Energy. The original lawsuit was filed June 27th of 1989. The department capitulated essentially to the lawsuit requirement to do a programmatic environmental impact statement. That's what the PEIS stands for. The PEIS that was demanded at the time called for an integrated study of the impacts and alternatives to building a new set of nuclear weapons facilities and the then proposed environmental cleanup of the facilities. There was a settlement in October of 1990 that actually called for the creation of two different programmatic environmental impact statements, and the department commenced work on doing an environmental impact, a PEIS on environmental management activities and a PEIS on nuclear weapons activities. Let me move to 1995. After spending, at that time, $60 million on this document, the department recognized that it was not going to be able to effectively look at each individual site where environmental restoration work was going on, and we published a notice that how do we characterize this without getting too much? We re-scoped it. That has changed the scope of it from trying to be comprehensive to everything to what many people were concerned about was way too narrow, that it just, instead of just minimizing the environmental restoration considerations, it eliminated the environmental restoration considerations and was focused only on the waste management activities. As a result of that, when the study was finished at a cost of $85 million in 1997, the plaintiffs filed another lawsuit. And the ensuing litigation led in December 1998 to a settlement agreement that called for three things. This study is one of them. We'll talk about this more. But the other two items, very briefly, are a central internet database that calls for very specific data to be provided publicly on a variety of wastes, contaminated facilities, contaminated environmental media like groundwater. And that database has been up and running. In this past year, we finally got it up and running fully. The central internet database, that's one. The other is a so-called Citizen Monitoring and Technical Assessment Fund that is independently administered outside of DOE by an organization called Resolve. And if you're interested in the $6.25 million funding, there's people here who are experts on that you can talk to or check the website. It's Resolve without an E, .org. the name of the organization is actually Resolve with an E, but if you look at Resolve with an E, you get a fertility clinic instead? I've checked that. So it's Resolve without an E if you're interested in a $6.25 million fund. So let's get back to the topic again of this report, and this is the Programmatic Environmental Impact Statement Study or the National Study on Long-Term Stewardship. I think there was a gosh, I don't know how much to get into the background. Maybe better to deal with and if people about why we did it. But there was a recognition then that although there wasn't a national decision necessarily being made, there were perhaps national issues of common between sites and a need for at least some integration between sites. If people are going to go out of business at one site and not necessarily have a DOE presence, then you darn well better figure out how you are going to deal with it. And that was, to some extent, a national issue. So hence the need for a national study. It is not an EIS. Some people are familiar with an environmental impact statement. it's not even an environmental assessment. But it does, the lawsuit settlement does require us to follow the public participation requirements similar to NEPA. That is, we have to follow the public participation requirements for scoping, which we did last October through February for doing a scoping process and getting public comment on that pursuant to the DOE regulations for NEPA. And then for the public comment process, we are required to follow the Council on Environmental Quality regulations for NEPA for public comment. So that's what we're here tonight in part trying to do. We actually had a public hearing, as it were. Did we call that a hearing? We called it a hearing where we actually spent the money and had a court reporter in Washington. But recognizing that not everybody can go back to Washington, it was just cheap for us because we just used a government office and hired a court reporter, and didn't cost us a lot of money. Not everybody could go to that. We knew that there was this national meeting already going on here in San Francisco with the Oakland Operations Office was helping sponsor on land use and land transfer, so we decided to piggyback on top of this meeting. So here we are tonight just trying to offer another opportunity to get public comment and have a useful dialogue about it. I think a lot of the details are spelled out in this, but let me just reinforce the major point about it, that it is not intended to address specific issues about any particular site. The reason is exactly the problems, to avoid the problems I mentioned earlier with the pre-PEIS, the Programmatic Environmental Impact Statement. That study tried to get into individual site-specific issues, and we ended up spending $85 million on a paper document where we had people from a national level trying to examine issues and alternatives of individual sites. It just didn't work. I mean, that's stuff you've got to leave to individual communities and regulators to work out for themselves and not sort of come in from Washington or Oak Ridge or wherever other place people were trying to do it from. So we're not getting into the site-specific issues. There is another activity, another report, in case you don't have enough paper going on right now. And this, hopefully, anybody who works on an individual site is already aware of this one. This one does get into site-specific issues. This is a separate report, and it's a report required by Congress on long-term stewardship. They asked us to report the coverage by having one report do the site-specific work and the other report look at the a different way.
What is the title of this report that's coming out?
Report to Congress.
Report to Congress.
Right.
And then what's the subtitle?
I know we can make one up, but we're just calling it the Report to Congress, or the NDAA report for the National Defense Authorization Act on long-term stewardship. We asked each of our field offices to work with our communities. Last December in 1999, when we first issued guidance on this, we asked each of our individual local field offices to contact their communities through the SSABs or whatever mechanisms they wanted to and show them the draft results and show them the report and get their comment feedback on it. In fact, the state of Tennessee had a legal requirement, it was pretty legal, between the governor and the Secretary of Energy that demanded that the state specifically approve of it with community input. And so there was a pretty high degree of public input in the case of the state of Tennessee and Oak Ridge because of the involvement, the interest, and concern of the governor's office there. So that is something that's pretty close to done. But again, if you haven't seen it and you have comments, we can make corrections. It sounds like we have a correction on one issue that will get fixed by Monday.
Yeah, Sue? Is there any mechanism set forth by the Department of Energy to link the problems at these specific sites? Like you say, I mean, the way you're dealing with it tonight, you're giving a national overview. I understand that. But if there is a problem at a specific site that is not being worked out, so to speak, as we've been dealing with in New Mexico, the Santa National Laboratory, we feel very much stuck, you know, with where we're at. You know, it's become a battle.
Right.
You know, and it's all over stewardship.
Okay. Why don't we talk
about... Is there some umbrella? I mean, is there some mechanism whereby, like, some type of mediation could come in?
Well, I'm sure there's. Why don't we talk about that offline? I know we've been trying to figure out a way to do that. I think that gets into the existing mechanisms, and that's really a good point for, you know, the fundamental thing about stewardship of what is this all about? Is this just another length of the pipeline, or should we, you know, be considering it during the cleanup process? And I think that's the concern a lot of communities have, is that, you know, they don't want just stewardship to be an excuse for not doing cleanup. But as we've seen, in some cases, you don't have a choice. The cleanup isn't technically feasible. But on the other hand, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place because the stewardship, you know, isn't necessarily reliable. So you've got to work out to improve your mechanisms for stewardship so they are reliable, or go back to your decision-making process. And that gets back to the appeals, you know, within your agency and stuff. So let's
Or it can be cleaned up, and it's simply too expensive.
Right. And that comes up. David?
Hold on, we'll get you a mic. I just wanted, people were straining on the last one. There you go.
Hi, I have a related question, and that's, you mentioned that this study is intended to be much more of an overview, but I think one thing that would help in making it seem a little bit more concrete is providing some specific examples or illustrations of some of the issues that you discuss in the report.
Okay, we're going to... We actually have a whole slide on that.
Okay.
Maybe I can do that later. Yeah, well, let me just throw out a couple. For example, funding. Funding is an issue that a lot of people are concerned about across the board. They're concerned about relying on annual appropriations, or should we have some sort of a trust fund? I mean, that's sort of a cross-cutting issue that many sites share in common. Or the need, as you mentioned, Sue, about making sure that you have full consideration of these long-term stewardship issues before you make a cleanup decision. Like, how reliable is this? How much is it going to cost? I mean, just the whole feedback mechanism. I mean, that's, and how do you do that? How do you incorporate into the decision-making process?
You know, I have a burning question to ask you.
Yes.
Hold on, they want the mic.
While I've got you on the line, of the over 100 sites, could you give us the number, doesn't have to be exact, of the number of contaminated areas we're looking at?
No, good question. Depends on, I hate to say this, but you know, somebody said, and anytime you have an expert, they always say, well, it depends on how, you know, what you mean by is or something. Somebody else said that, so I suppose. It's about 4,000, I guess I would say. And it, and that would be by counting release sites. We have a database of release sites. But I would warn you, if you actually want to provoke a real nerd response, I'll give you a brief one here. For instance, it's the number of release sites. But release sites is... something that doesn't necessarily encompass another unit of measure called an operable unit. Sometimes operable units actually have several within a release site, or in some cases you have several release sites within an operable unit. But of course, release sites don't necessarily include buildings. And does a building include all the related facilities? What about the appurtenances and the valve vaults and the pipes? Are those separate release sites, or are they part of the building?
When you say release?
Release sites, yeah. Release sites serve a term of art under the Superfund statute, but of course a lot of our facilities are not cleaned up under the Superfund statute. They're done through Atomic Energy Act authorities and DOE orders, or the RCRA authorities, or even the Clean Water Act. I mean, the tanks at Savannah River, remarkably, are actually not considered waste facilities for purposes of regulation. They're considered water treatment facilities and regulated through the Clean Water Act. So this is how you can spend a whole career, you know. Yeah, or something safer. Yeah. So it's a lot of them, but I mean it is a challenge to us, because shouldn't at the end of this process, shouldn't the government be able to provide a list of where the sites are, how big they are, where they're located, have a GIS-based database, so that anybody going out to build a facility, build a new pipeline, or dig a utility trench through something, they can have some reliability that there's a map that shows where the contamination is. I mean, right now in the United States, we have these 1-800 missed utility numbers we can call up and make sure you're not digging through an electric line or a gas line, right? We don't have anything for contamination, but there's public information freely available to allow you to avoid contaminated areas. You know, I guess I think of our customers, not the people who wear ties and go to meeting and think about, you know, release sites, but rather the guy or gal in the Ford F-150 pickup truck who goes out every day and puts stakes in the ground to build something. Do I build the daycare center here, or there or over there, and you need to have a map put on a rifle rack so they can go out and figure out where it is. Those should be our customers. You know, so this is not an academic exercise. It should be somebody who can actually go out and do something useful and protective of people. And we're a ways from getting there, but we're working on it until January 19th. So this report should be out soon. I think this is a first cut at it. It will have maps in it. It will have listings and estimated numbers. And then let me just preview some, because I think there's some interesting things that come out of it. I think this is really the nuts and bolts of stuff, of, you know, being able to articulate what are the tasks you have to carry out, because it's only then when you have a really clear sense of you know, how you're really going to do it, how are you going to manage it. I mean, what kind of people should you hire to do this work, and how much money do you need to do it? You have to figure out what the work is to know what kind of people you're going to hire and what kind of contractors, or, you know, how much money it'll cost. And we don't completely have a sense of what the work is yet to be done for long-term stewardship. But this report will give us the first preliminary estimate. And right now, the preliminary estimate is that after all the cleanup is done, and we finish spending all this money, it'll cost about $100 million a year just to maintain the long-term stewardship over these sites. That doesn't necessarily do any more cleanup. That's just to keep bad things from happening, to keep people from being exposed, to prevent the records from being lost, to allow you to go back and collect monitoring, sample, do the analysis. You know, all the things that, you know, the Grand Junction people already do here. We've got a couple of people from the Grand Junction office. But, you know, these people have been doing this work for some years. They have experience. This is not necessarily rocket science, but it requires, you know, a solid professional cadre of people, and we need to build up that cadre of people, you know, so that we actually have a group of people who are sort of environmentalists who do this. There's a lot of other things we're doing now. I don't want to get into the details of all these things. Let me just mention a couple of them. There's a few people at individual sites. One is that we've been working on planning guidance for individual sites that will require each and every individual site to put together a long-term stewardship plan, and it will lay out in more detail what the activities are and how much it will cost. The other policy we've been working on that is all but approved now is one that answers the question, who does long-term stewardship? I mean, this may seem bureaucratic and trivial to some of you, but right now we're in the Office of Environmental Management within DOE, and we've been paying for it out of our budget, but should the Office of Defense Programs do it, or should Nuclear Energy do it? After we're done the cleanup, who should pay for it? Who should do it? And that policy should be issued soon, and the answer is that whoever the landlord is will be doing it. So in some cases, the work will go back to the Office of Defense Programs within DOE. And I know that concerns some people, but I guess the only good news about this so-called handoff policy is that before it gets transferred to defense programs, there has to be in a place a very solid technical plan put together with full public involvement about what really is going to take place and make sure there's funding for it. So there's a whole lot of other issues going on right now. Maybe the last thing that some of you are familiar with is a site database. Secretary Richardson committed to putting together a site database of all the sites, not only the sites where we're doing cleanup right now, but in a lot of cases there were sites that were involved in nuclear weapons production years ago where a private entity ended up doing the work. And when you add those sites up, it's as many as 600 sites around the country. So there's a range of projects and data being put together. Approach. Bob, how much should I get into the approach? I think we've talked about the approach. Essentially, we had a scoping period. People told us what the issues were. And so let me go right to some of the issues, the top seven. We actually have, really 27. We had an overhead with 27 issues. And Tom?
Hold on, let me get your mic.
I appreciate, Tom, your generosity in suggesting there's some sort of a flow, but I'll pay you for that later.